Good morning. So this morning I want to talk about the... hi, David. Good to see you. There's a couple of spaces in here, a couple of seats in here. This morning I want to talk about the first precept in Buddhism, which is not killing, but nurturing all life. So we are going to be having an initiation ceremony here in a few weeks, and people who have been sewing these miniature versions of robes will be initiated, and one of the things they'll be doing is reciting the precepts, starting with the first precept, and committing themselves to nurturing all life. And this is done in an initiation ceremony, it's done in an ordination ceremony when someone becomes a priest, and then it's done at the very end when they're so advanced that they no longer have to be in Zen training anymore, and they're free to go. Well, they're really not that free, because not killing but nurturing all life is what that focus is. Again, always. So I want to talk a little bit about this today. So Buddhism, really, Buddhist practice is a countercultural practice. It's a counterculture. Originally, as we understand the historical context, historical Buddha was creating a counterculture, a civilizing culture within a culture that was not very civilized. Now, I don't want to slam indigenous peoples when I say this, because I think that they are very civil. So I'm using civil in terms of nurturing all life. That's my meaning of civil. So this was a counterculture that Buddha offered, that he offered. As many of you know, there was a very rigid caste system at the time. And according to my daughter-in-law, who is Indian, she said, "Oh, you think there are only six castes?" She said, "There are 16 castes, 22 castes." She said, "I could sit with you for an hour and tell you all the castes, how they relate to the color of skin and the da 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 da." So, Buddha said, "That's not my deal. We're all interdependent. We're all interdependent. That's not my deal. That's not what I teach. That's not what I feel in my heart. That's not what I teach." It was a counterculture, and. It sounds like, very much like, do unto others as they would do unto you. And it is, although in Buddhism, the others are you. The others are you. So if you're hurting the others, you're hurting yourself. You are the others. So that was the original counterculture. Hi, come on in. I'm going to let these folks sit down. Somebody could sit there on a cushion. There are two chairs back there. Pretty soon, we're running out of space. And pretty soon, you just have to sit on the floor, I guess. Which is what Zen's all about anyway. So that was the creation of that counterculture. And somehow, Buddha managed to do it without getting... hung or crucified, and we could have a whole big discussion about that. Why that happened? It's interesting, but that would take a whole talk, so I won't go into that. So that creation of that counterculture. Then we have Zen's introduction into China by an Indian Buddhist who was really believed in meditation and in nurturing all life. At the time that Buddhism is beginning to sort of wane in India, it's becoming part of the establishment. Usually, when these religions come part of the establishment, they lose their vitality. I don't know why we do this, but we do this as human beings. So, Bodhidharma, from India came to China with the idea in mind that he would gently, or maybe not so gently, because he's not known for his gentleness, present a countercultural alternative to Chinese life at the time, in the 6th century. A countercultural alternative. And the story is that the emperor of China was very interested in seeing him, because in China there was no caste system, but heaven. The emperor was a manifestation of heaven. There was no God in Confucianism, but heaven. And the emperor is a manifestation of heaven. And then the scholars, the Confucian scholars, are the manifestations of the emperor. And then there's everybody else. Of course, the women being at the very bottom. So the emperor wanted to see this guy. So, a story that I've told many, many times, and I'll just tell it in a very brief way. The emperor went to see him, and he said, "What's the first principle of your holy teaching?" And Bodhidharma said, "A vast spaciousness with nothing holy about it. A vast spaciousness, a vast openness with nothing holy about it. Nurturing all life. With that kind of spaciousness, with that kind of openness, where we're not saying someone's more holy than someone else. There's nurturance of all life. Just comes through. And so, as Buddha went off into the rural areas to do his thing, so did Bodhidharma go off in the mountains to do his thing. That's where they started their countercultures, in the mountains, away from civilization, so that they could present this really quite civilized way of being. It's quite civilized to be like this. Then the next guy, Dogen. So now we've moved into the 13th century in Japan, and Buddhism is already in Japan, but it's corrupt, and they're fighting. And the armies of monks are fighting each other, as they did in almost all of the Asian countries. Sorry, you guys. And they're the Shingon monks. Those are the ones who have psychic ability. They can read minds. They can teleport. They can do all kinds of things. Shingon, shamanic Buddhism. Cool. Pretty cool. Fun stuff, right? If you don't fight about it, if you still nurture all life, the Shingons were competing with the Tendais, who were the Buddhist scholars. They had replaced the Confucian monks as the Buddhist scholar monks. They knew more about the sutras. They knew more about the 10 thises and the 32 thats and the 64 the others. And you remember why there was all this numerical stuff? Because it was a non-literate culture, so they memorize in terms of numbers. Here's this going on in Japan, and Dogen is saying, well, maybe if I go back to China, I can find this counterculture. And of course he spends 3 years in China and finds an old teacher who seems to really be still inside and really be unpretentious and just naturally nurturing all life. So he says, "Oh, that's my man." Not exactly in those words. And he hangs out with him. He hangs out with him and tries to imbibe his teaching and just do zazen with him as much as possible. Retreats, daily zazen, working together. And then he brings his thoughts about a Buddhist counterculture in his heart, in his mind, back to Japan. I'm going to try to create a counterculture here in Japan. And I'm going to go off in the mountains to do it, because I can't do it in Tokyo. It'll just be overwhelmed. I'm going to go off in the mountains. So, well, of course, where he went off, all these people, where they went off in the mountains, then they lately become, Heiji now is a huge tourist trap. It was off in the mountains in 1242, and now it's huge tourists coming every day, Kadagir used to say there'd be so many busloads of tourists that he never had time to sit in meditation because he had to just take care of the tourists all the time. This is, you know, several hundred years later, right? A counterculture. That's what this is about. Because we're going counter to the dominant culture, which is where people hurt each other. People hurt themselves. They're mean. They're mean to themselves. They're mean to each other. So my teacher, Suzuki Roshi, came to San Francisco from Japan came in the late 50s and started his little Zen group in the early 60s, hoping to bring a counterculture. Because how did he feel about Japan? He said to me, in Japan, they just do ritual all the time. He said, they don't know how to really live. That's what he said to me. They don't know how to live. And he said, they have very fancy ritual with fancy robes. And they've forgotten how to open their hearts. So he thought, well, maybe he would bring a counterculture, try to bring a counterculture to the U.S. Surprise, you know what surprised him? When he came to San Francisco, there already was a counterculture. It was a very weird counterculture. Very weird. He was very surprised about this counterculture. He actually never put it down. But it must have been weird to him, don't you think? How could it not have been? How could it not have been? And that was a counterculture that was the end of the beatnik era and the beginning of the hippie era. You know, kind of coming together, right? In San Francisco, where I was a young, impressionable man. So the thing about this counterculture in San Francisco, which is really kind of the birth of Soto Zen in the United States, I guess, although, you know, let's not get too attached to that. let's not necessarily believe in that. When you think you're present at the birth of something, then you get very hard and rigid. I was the man. I'm the man. Please. Then you don't nurture all life. So my friend said to me in about, I don't remember the year, you can look it up, about 1967, he said he was riding in a car with Suzuki Roshi, and Beatles were on the radio. And they were singing, I am the walrus. I am the walrus. And the line that is it Paul McCartney or John Lennon? I don't remember, was singing was, I am he, as you are me, and we are all together, right? And Suzuki listened to it. And the guy said to Suzuki, yes, yes. And Suzuki, what do you think of that? Suzuki said, good, good. He said, enlightenment, but dry enlightenment, very dry. So this was my teacher's expression about us. You know, we psychedelic out. We had these experiences through peyote, through mescaline, through lysergic acid, and it was all over the place. And of course, lots of grass. We had this a breaking down the separate sense of self and feeling connected to everything. But it was a chemically induced high, and when we came down, we were more egotistical than ever because we had found it. I saw my dad. I thought, oh, you poor thing. You poor thing. Come on. And, you know, we had all this idea about slipping LSD into people's water, which was awful. Because then they would have a psychotic break. It wouldn't help them. You have to have the right set, the right setting. It has to be spiritual, really. And even then, you don't know. Dry enlightenment. Dry enlightenment. Because in this practice, we become moist. We come moist with the nectar of feeling close to life. As our mind settles down, we feel just a little bit of space between our thoughts. It only has to be this much space. There's moisture in that space. There's wetness in that space. And within that moisture, there's There's connectedness. There's intimacy. There's love. Moist. Forget about enlightenment. Just moist. And then you don't need enlightenment. Enlightenment's just a term. Luckily, we don't talk about it too much anymore. I seem to talk about it a lot, but I don't have students coming asking me about it too much, which is good, because it's just an idea. You radically change your psyche with this practice, but it's little by little. It's teeny bit by teeny bit. Your biochemistry, little by little, day by day, retreat by retreat, begins to change, so that you really do feel like I am you and you are me and we are all together. I mean, you feel that way. It's not some song. It is a song. It's a song that comes from your heart, not from something you learned or some drug or some alcohol or anything like that. So, in this practice of not killing and nurturing all life, there's a lot of discussion about food. Food. Boy, did we spend a lot of time my first few years talking about food. First few years of Zen practice. I could give a whole hour talk on that, too. The macrobiotics and the this and the that and on and on and on and on. Food. Well, food is a big deal. Food is a big deal, and we're killing food, and we're killing life when we eat. It doesn't matter what we eat; we're killing life, and we can do it the way some Buddhists did, and that actually turned into the Jain religion, which came out of Hinduism in the 10th century, really was affected big time by Buddhism, big time by Buddhism. Buddhism was dying out; Jain religion was developing. And the Jains said, we won't eat anything that disturbs the earth. We won't eat anything that kills a plant. So when I went to India to visit my new, I guess, in-laws, because my daughter-in-law's family on her father's side is Jain. Let's see, father's side. Yeah. I don't know. I get mixed up. They're Jain. So I met her grandfather, and he was eating leaf and broccoli soup. It looked really good to me, and I tasted it. It was great. And there he is, eating his leaf and broccoli soup. I don't know. Well, there are lots of things you can eat that without pulling up plant, without killing plants. On the other end of the spectrum, we have the Tibetans. They're a hunting people. They lived high up. They hunted. They ate meat. They still do eat meat. But they tried to do it in a very reverential attitude. They still try to do it. To sustain my life, I'm eating you, Brother Crow. I'm eating you. Thank you for allowing me to eat you. With great reverence, just like, and of course, I've had very little experience with Tibetan Buddhism, but a lot of experience with Lakota spirituality, where before the late night ceremonies, sometimes they would, or after late night ceremonies, sometimes they would serve puppy soup. Puppy soup. Oh my God, who eat puppy soup? Well, the dogs were very valuable to Lakotas. Lakotas had very little in the way to sustain them except deer. So eating a puppy, really gave their hearts to the puppy. They cried when they ate the puppy. They thanked the puppy. All my relatives, Matakiasan, 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 with great tears of gratitude in Lakota spirituality. Great tears of gratitude. So the story about food that people seem to like a lot, I've told many times, is a story about Suzuki Roshi being invited to a barbecue, and at this barbecue, apparently we were all eating hamburgers, although I thought I had given up eating hamburgers by then, but I don't know. We were all eating hamburgers, apparently. I guess this is before I got pure. Suzuki was there, kind of a guest, you know. So they brought out a nice little tray for him with a little miso soup and a little rice. And you know how the Japanese like to have everything pretty? It was this pretty little tray with all the colors. None of the foods mixed together. Japanese don't mix foods together. You know, they have this great aesthetic. My teacher at Tassajara used to tell me, the way the food looks is more important than it tastes, Tim. And I was really hungry. I thought, oh. He said, no, it's the beauty. He said, it satisfies your hunger just to look at the food. I thought, not me. Not me. Not in these extreme situations of living in the Zen monastery. No way. Well, that's another story, how he would sneak off. Another story, how he would sneak off and get food. Sneak into the kitchen at night in the monastery. Get chocolate. Because food is a big deal for us as human beings. See, we're all so well, we don't know what it's like for people in Bangladesh right now. My wife's niece is staying with us right now. She's just come back from Bangladesh. She said their whole lives are about how to not be hungry. Everything is about how to not be hungry. And of course they're still hungry, but how to deal with the pain and the malnutrition. Their whole lives. We don't know about that. Maybe we'll never have to. But we should know about it, because they're us. They're us. So we should open ourselves to it. Pay attention to it. Because they're us. So anyway, oh, Suzuki Roshi at the barbecue. So, of course, you guys know the punchline already, most of you too, been around for a while. They brought him out this nice little tray. He said, I want a hamburger. Now, why does that story get repeated over and over again in all the annals and all the Zen mind? You go online and you read that story 5 times because Suzuki Roshi has become a mythological figure now, at least online. Of course, who hasn't online, right? Why? Well, for one thing, he wasn't being special. He was nurturing the life of those beings there by being with them, not being special. I'm the special guy here. I got the special way of showing him how to be. How can you be interconnected with all life when you do that? How can you be really exchanging intimacy when you do that? And then also he was showing us this rule in your head you guys have about anything. It's just a rule in your head. It's not big life. It's not a great spaciousness with nothing holy about it. You have this rule in your head about being holy by eating right. And then you get attached to it and then you fight about it. We used to fight. I mean, we didn't come to fisticuffs at Tassajara about the food. We would fight about it all the time. We were deprived. We felt we were middle class people who had never had to deal with this kind of thing before. Felt deprived. So a rule in our heads about what's going to make us peaceful or what's going to be good, we need to be careful of. But still, not killing but nurturing all life can help us. Not as a rule in our head, but as a direction that we want to go. It's a direction we want to open up our heart, still our minds, to manifest that. So war. What about war? Not killing but nurturing all life. What about war? Well, from a Buddhist point of view, war is tragic. It's unnecessary. Organized violence causes harm. It causes suffering. It pollutes the minds and hearts of those who use it. And it creates cycles of hatred and retribution. cycles, generations of hatred and retribution. It inflicts terrible damage to our psyche, to the psyche of those we war against, both psychological and physical. Terrible damage. So about 5 years ago, I don't know, maybe something like that, 6-7 years ago, I went to Alabama. I'd never been to the South before. I'd never been to the South, but since my nephew is from rural Alabama, I went to rural Alabama. And, you know, I had been lots of places in the world when I went to the South. I'd been to Guatemala, where the culture is very different. I'd been to Botswana. I'd been to lots of places. But I had more trepidation about going to rural Alabama than any place I'd been in the whole world. Well, this is the remnants of the Civil War still. I had trepidation, and my nephew said, I'm going to have to tell him that even though you're a Yankee, you're my uncle. That's what my nephew Nick said to me. I'm going to have to tell him that even though you're a Yankee, you're my uncle. More than 150 years ago, that war was fought. And yet, there's still this bifurcation in our country, this mistrust in our country from that war. 650,000 people were killed in that war. 650,000 men, and many, many all more casualties. 2.5% of the male population was killed in that war. And, you know, 2.5% of the male population is about 10% of the total population. Can you imagine if we had a war now and 10% of our population was killed? What that would be like? And they're still suffering about it. They're still upset about it. They? And so are we. We're scared and they're upset. Because the Confederate flag for them represents something. Now, I'm talking about white blacks. White Southerners, not black. It represents a way of life that we squelched, through our murderous rage. Now that's their point of view, right? Right. So the Dhammapada says, everybody fears being struck by a rod. Everybody fears death. Therefore, knowing this, feeling for others as for yourself, do not kill others or cause others to kill. Everybody fears being struck by a rod, life being dear to all. Therefore, knowing this, feeling for others as for yourself, do not kill. Abstaining from killing and not causing killing, him do I call a noble one. An early Buddhist sutra. And in Hinduism, at least in the time of Buddha, a soldier in a just war would be reborn in a heavenly realm, was sure to develop enough good karma so they could come back in a caste even higher than they were. And in early Buddhism and still in contemporary Buddhism, for people who believe in reincarnation, if you engage in the military, if you fight, you're likely to be born as an animal or in a hell realm, especially if you die with a feeling of anger or hatred. And Buddhism is based, especially Zen Buddhism, on the peaceful presence of folks who have imbued themselves in meditation practice, their peaceful presence. The historical Buddha himself, his peaceful presence is what's alluded to time and time again. There were warring factions, there were people arguing, and just his peaceful presence, just his being there, just his being open and available. Suzuki Roshi in San Francisco, just his peaceful presence. Just his peaceful presence. And, of course, we may be doing some projecting. I know we projected on him. But the peaceful presence really is there. You really can imbibe it, and as you imbibe it, it begins to change your cellular makeup. It just does. just does. So when Thich Nhat Hanh came here to Zen Center in about 1980, I'm not sure what the year was, but around 1980. Do you remember, Susan, when it was? Yeah. Katagiri, the head teacher here, who also had a peaceful presence, went to meet him at the airport. And then he came back, and this was before Thich Nhat Hanh was famous. He wouldn't have come here now. I mean, because everybody wants him. But he wasn't famous then. He was just he was cool. He was cool. He was famous enough we wanted him, you know. So Katagiri came back, and the first talk Katagiri gave was picking Thich Nhat Hanh up at the airport. Do you remember this talk, Susan? He said, he didn't know, different kind of Buddhism, even. It's supposedly it's Zen, but it's very different from Japanese Zen. So he knows nothing about the guy. He doesn't know, and his practice is quite different. He picks him up at the airport. He comes back. He says to us in his Sunday talk, "My, I picked this man up at the airport, and when I saw him walking into the airport and then coming down to get his baggage, I felt great peace." Great peace, great stillness, great joy. He said, "I just felt it." So there you go. Years. But this takes years, years. But it only takes a moment. See, if I tell you it takes years, you'll quit. If I only tell you it only takes a moment, you'll stay. It really only takes a moment, but it takes lots of only moments. Lots of only moments. So, little by little, we don't imbibe chemicals. That's not part of our way. And we may be, as Suzuki Roshi said to my friends, not for or against marijuana, but we just don't. It ain't our way. It ain't our way. We change our biochemistry by getting wet in life, by getting wet through our zazen, feeling in our pores as our mind settles down, our connection to everything. And letting the Dharma rain to penetrate our clothes, our skin, our bones, our marrow, penetrate in its own time, in its own fashion, not in Tim's fashion, not in Ben's fashion, not in David's fashion. So, and in about whatever year that was, back then in those 60s, I decided I wanted to be a conscientious objector because I didn't want to go fight in that war. No way. I was protesting that war. I wasn't going to protest the war. I wasn't going to fight in the war I was protesting against. So I went to Suzuki Roshi and I said, "Will you write me a letter about me being a Buddhist practitioner so I can become a conscientious objector?" He said, "Conscientious objector? What's that?" I explained to him. He said, "Oh, well, okay, you write the letter." I said, "No, the letter has to come from you." He said, "Okay, you write it and give it to me." So I wrote the letter. I gave it to him. And then he brought it back to me a few days later. And what he had done is he had copied everything that I had written into his best, I guess, English. I mean, I don't know. He copied it. And it was literally everything I had said, except where I'd put in "follower of the Buddha," he said "strict follower of the Buddha." Because he had seen enough followers of the Buddha in Japan who hurt people, thought they were better than people, who went up to people. So, but I was delighted. I had my letter. I sent my letter in, and I didn't get drafted. Thank you, Suzuki Roshi. Thank you. And then not too long after that, I was, and I've told this story before, I was I tried to do my Vietnam protesting very peacefully. I tried to do Zazen first. try to think about, be very peaceful. But my zazen was not even, hadn't even penetrated my clothes yet, you know. Hadn't penetrated. It takes a while even for it to penetrate your clothes sometimes. And so I was at Stanford, and Hubert Humphrey was coming to give a speech, and this is when we were really mad. Well, most of you guys are too young to even know about this. We were really mad because we thought, because Lyndon Johnson had taken Humphrey as his lapdog, and Humphrey was going around telling about how good Vietnam was and how we were saving the Vietnamese. So Humphrey was coming to speak at Stanford. I had no idea Humphrey was a good guy. In Minnesota, when I came and I told that story, people were, about what I did, they were horrified. They did that to Hubert Humphrey? Oh, no, I'm not going to say this in Minnesota again. But anyway, to say what I did. So he was giving a talk at Stanford. I was a Stanford student. We had a full auditorium, but most of us in the back of the auditorium, we were pissed. We were pissed. And so we left the talk before he ended so that we could encounter him. I don't know what, we didn't have a plan about what we were going to do. We were just going to encounter him. We saw the Secret Service, but there were more of us than there were Secret Service. And we were going to encounter him there on the steps. And, of course, they snuck him out the side door, right? But our leaders saw them sneaking him out the side door. And then the first thing I knew, I was in a huge group of people chasing Hubert Humphrey. Chasing Hubert Humphrey. I mean, what would we have done to him if we... What would we have eaten him? Was that all my relatives? I mean, what would we have done? I mean, and it happened so fast. So fast. I went from, oh, this is cool. I'm just doing my zazen to... Shh. Boy, that's why we have to be sincere about our practice, don't you think? Even now that happens to me. Even now. Even now. And I didn't tell Suzuki about it because I was too ashamed. But I thought to myself, get thee to a nunnery, Tim. Get thee to a nunnery. And I doubled my commitment to practice. I tripled my commitment to practice. And of course, the problem with war is that in war, there's a general premise that the ends justify the means. That means that if the ends are good, you can use whatever means necessary. If it's a peace. But, you know, that's so un-Dogen, that's so un-Zen, because the means and the ends are really not two. They can never be separated. Never be separated. Violence for the sake of peace is just not only a logical contradiction, it's a heart contradiction. And yet we have in Buddhism a lot of violence. Sri Lanka, the last 50 years. Well, Lenny, you were there. And still continuing, I think, but much, much abated. The Buddhists are the ones who are propagating. They're the establishment. They're the nation state. They're propagating the violence. They've been propagating the violence. Japan in World War II. No wonder Suzuki tried to get out of Japan during World War II. They, as in Christianity, in all religions, they took these central religious teachings and then used them as a justification for war. Emptiness. Soldiers, Japanese soldiers, everything's empty. No one's being killed. It's all empty. No one's being killed. And the kamikaze pilots were trained in Zen, Rinzai Zen. Act fully in the moment. Give yourself completely. Go beyond life and death. So we have this happening. We have great, wonderful teachings being subverted to protect war. Having said that, I need to qualify what I said now. because I'm a student of my teacher, is not always so. But if you, which is not rules in your head, but follow, pay attention to what is in front of you, what's manifesting itself. Sometimes we do need to fight to defend our country, our home, our family. Sometimes we may need to do that. But we need to be very careful about that. Did we need to do that in the Civil War? Did we need to do that in Vietnam? Did we need to do that in World War II? More likely we did, I think. But you may have a different idea about this. But I think more likely we did. Not wrong. Yet to harbor hate for our enemies is a poison. War sows the seeds of future harmful karma, even if it's unavoidable. But sometimes it is unavoidable. It is unavoidable. And the last thing that I want to talk about in regard to not killing and nurturing all life, let's see, I see I have a little bit of time, is the mind in Zazen. Because, you know, we are the Zazen, we're the Zen school, we are the meditation school of Buddhism. And I talk many times about this, but I need to bring it up again. Not to do violence in our sitting practice, internal violence to our own minds, to our own psyches. And when violent thoughts come up, when violent emotions come up, what do? We don't kill them. We don't kill them. Because if you kill them, they're like paramecium that proliferate. You cut them in two and then there are two more. So we don't. We recognize, we don't criticize. Criticism begets war. It begets internal war. If we know we're criticizing, we stop and recognize. We don't criticize ourselves for criticizing. We stop and recognize. And then we accept. We open up our hearts to whatever is inside. Maybe something awful. Maybe something awful. Whatever it is, we just recognize it and accept it. And then we refrain from acting it out because we want to nurture all life. We refrain from acting out on a cushion because if we can refrain from doing it internally, we can refrain from doing it internally. And we just return to our activity. And as you know, I've been calling this rar. So we're letting go in our Zen meditation. Little by little, we're being able to let go of all of our obsessive thinking. And the problem is that 98.2% of our thinking is obsessive thinking. Or something. I just made that up, right? 88.3%. We're letting go of that. We're letting it drop away so that we can experience a great spaciousness with nothing holy about it. And then we're whole. Then we're whole. And Dogen refers to this as the body and mind falling away. But this people get very confused by this, and they think, oh, the body and mind fall away, and then there's just spirit? Oh, no. He's really, if you read him, he's talking about the falling away of our obsession about our bodies and our minds and our obsession in terms of preserving our sense of separate body and separate mind. So, little by little, this through this meditation process, all of this residue just on its own drops away. And that's how we create a counterculture. That's how we've been perpetuating this counterculture for 2,500 years. And lots of times it's gotten polluted. Lots of times it's gotten perverted. And we've done it ourselves. But then we come back again. We come back again. We try again. It's never too late. Never too late. We commit ourselves again to nurturing all life, including Tim's needs. He'd take care of little Ben, little Martin, little Laney, take little Jeff, take care of them, their needs. They're not going to go away. And they're always little because it's the little child in us, you know. I mean, I'm 70, and little Tim is just as active as he used to be, as he ever was. And if you think you're going to get rid of that through Zen practice, and go study with some other teacher. But be careful. Be careful. Because this is not about getting rid of this practice. It's not about getting rid of. We want to get to a deeper, a higher level. This is about opening. Opening. So here by Lake Calhoun, we are creating a counterculture. Isn't it cool? We don't know how we're doing it. We have no idea. We're just committing ourselves day after day, moment after moment, to sitting here quietly, as peacefully as we can, letting those thoughts come in, do their dance, pass through, noticing a little space sometimes. You only need this much space. This much space has the whole universe within it. It's the whole universe in just this much space. So that we can sustain this wonderful counterculture. Create and sustain. Right in the middle of a dominant culture. Which is not bad. We're not the good culture. If we think we're the good culture and the dominant culture is bad, then we're going to be chasing, who we're going to chase next? Let's see. Who's the next person to chase? Oh, get a bunch of Tea Party people out in the yard and we'll chase them, right? So that's what I want to say today, you guys. Time for one or two questions or comments. Stacy.
Will you say a little bit about the concept of killing in self-defense?
Killing in self-defense. Well, in self-defense, often we'll have to kill. Often we will have to kill. And that's all I can say about it. But when we kill in self-defense, as much as possible, we just do it. And we realize that there's going to be some negative karma even from killing in self-defense. That is, the stuff is going to come back, and we're going to remember, and we're going to be haunted. And it, you know, that's just negative karma. But if I kill in self-defense, I've never had to do this yet. then I come back to my Zazen mind as soon as I can. I come back to, and I just let it all fall away. And I'm not hateful of the person I kill. But some hatred might come in, some fear might come in, and then that just becomes my practice for the next year. Just to let that hatred and fear come in and just be with it without doing anything but just accepting it. Just accepting it. And then letting it, that too shall pass. But of course, there are times that people do have to kill in self-defense. But I don't know. Sometimes people think they have to kill in self-defense and they don't. There's another way out. They can do more of an Aikido way out. You know what I mean by an Aikido way out? Yeah, you would hope so. Far Zen is pretty advanced, whatever that is. Often there will be an Aikido way out. You know, in Aikido, you go with the energy of your supposed opponent. You sink into that energy of your supposed opponent. And then your opponent loses their feeling of wanting to be your opponent. Right? But that doesn't always work. Nothing always works. Just in our heads, we're going to get everything to work. Sorry. Uh-huh. Go to another Zen center. But that's the Zen center in the sky. You know. Okay, Stacy? Not okay.
How in that case do you value the self more than the other? And recognize that threat?
Well, So your point, so say a little bit, be a little bit, I think I get what your point is, but say it, but tell me what your point is.
I guess, like, if I... If I am not so self-concerned that I view another as only an attacker, but rather as a part of self, of my own self, how or why does that snap into valuing myself?
Yes. Well, you know, that's a good question, and there's no answer to that, and it depends maybe on the situation, on the depth of our practice, and you've heard me talk lots of times, and you know this, we have a built-in instinctual drive for self-preservation. Human beings do. And how does Buddhist practice mellow that and modify that, and to what degree, and what circumstances, with what people, and which is better or worse? I wouldn't even go there myself. Because then we get to trying to figure it out and argue about it and what's best. We know all kinds of things about people sacrificing their lives for their children or their loved ones, but sacrificing your life for an enemy? Huh. Sure, why not? But sometimes why also? Because self-preservation. I mean, I want to stick around here for a few years and enjoy this nectar with you. Now, does that mean that I'm going to kill the guy who is sneaking into my bedroom with an axe? I don't know. Maybe so, maybe not. Ben.
Can I just make an observation? I can't resist. You know, you're talking about the Civil War in the South, and part of the karma we carry from that is not just from the war itself, but from the throughout American history until this very moment, we have sustained institutional
violence against black people. That's right.
And the Civil War had various concerns, but one of the concerns involved in it had to do with that.
That's right.
But there have been other movements that want warfare, which address that concern.
Yes.
In particular, the nonviolent movement, civil rights movement of the Pacific.
That's right.
60s.
That's right.
Nonviolence is a direct translation of ahimsa.
That's right.
Which is actually the word that's in the text you're reading. Nonviolence, non-harming. And what I like to remember about nonviolence is it is effective. It is powerful. It worked. We can say it didn't work because Trayvon Martin got shot. But how many other people got shot before? It works. Nonviolence works. And the last thing I want to say is you can't do nonviolence for anyone else. You can only choose. You only have one thing. Your choice for nonviolence.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
On the way in this morning, I was on the radio, and another Tibetan monk burned himself to death.
Yes.
Is that doing violence to yourself? Is that really, you know, I mean, it's a form of protest, but I don't quite grasp whether it's legitimate form of
Well, I can't answer that question, and luckily, time's almost up. because I don't know. I don't know the context. I don't know the people. I don't know their motivation. I don't know the level of their spaciousness. I just don't know. I don't want to judge. If I were going to judge and generalize, I'd have to know so much more, so much more. Thank you.